Good morning, Your Honors. Before Ms. Zeldin begins, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Brian Rawlson, on behalf of Potter, Anderson, Caroon, for the appellees. Stacey Evans from Powell Goldstein submitted pro hoc vice and will be presenting the argument today on behalf of appellees.
Welcome to the court.
May it please the court, Jessica Zeldin on behalf of the plaintiffs below, who are shareholders and a former director of the defendant First Niles. Can you hear me? Good, thank you. We're here on a motion to dismiss. The court below dismissed the complaint at issue despite well-pled allegations of entrenchment and self-interest. Specifically, the complaint pled that the board authorized the sale of the company once it found out that their positions Once it found out that there were alternatives that would allow the board to keep their positions, they radically shifted course, instead rejecting the sale process out of hand, despite the fact that it offered a substantial premium, was admittedly fair by the company's financial advisors, and without any deliberation. Instead, the board pursued a reclassification, which was their preferred alternative, whereby the stock of First Niles was delisted from NASDAQ. As a result of, yes, Your Honor.
If I understand it correctly, and, you know, I think it's important that we address this appeal in light of the claims for relief that were dismissed. The decision to basically to back away from a sale, that is to turn down whatever expression of interest was conveyed to the company, is a separate cause of action. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. There are three claims in our complaint. One relates to the sale, one relates to the disclosures, and one relates to the reclassification.
Okay. With respect to the sale, what relief were you asking the court to grant if you were to prevail on that claim?
We're asking for the lost opportunity to engage in the maximizing first place bid.
Well, how? I mean, are you looking for money? Are you looking for equitable relief?
Money damages, Your Honor.
Okay. And for the reclassification?
The relief could either take the form of money damages or equitable relief. There could be an order to rescind the transaction or the value of the loss of a liquid market.
All right. And the disclosures related to the proxy statement that was issued in connection with the second a cause of action.
That's correct. The proxy was in connection with the reclassification claim.
And any misdisclosures, that is, if there were any, they related to that transaction.
That's correct. There's no allegations or claims by the defendants of ratification with respect to the sale claim. And in particular, Your Honor, this conduct, plaintiffs alleged, deprived the plaintiffs of a substantial premium for their shares and eliminated the public market. That's what gives rise to our claims of damages on both claims. But at the same time, ensure that defendants' positions would be secured and that they would not face the same liquidity crisis. Giving plaintiffs the benefits of the well-pled allegations of the complaint, which this court must do and the court below should have done, plaintiffs submit that this complaint states a claim. Turning first to the sale claim, regardless of whether this claim is viewed under the rubric of business judgment or UNICAL, it states a claim. Delaware courts have noted, and now I'm quoting from Justice Jacobs in Christodoulos versus London, that corporate directors are not free to ignore an acquisition proposal for reasons extraneous to their good faith informed business judgment. But that's exactly what happened here. The directors voted against the first place sale for the purpose of entrenching themselves in office. While the court below recognized that rejecting a sale for entrenchment purposes could state a claim, it failed to credit plaintiffs' well-pled allegations from which this conduct was inferable. Turning to good faith, the complaint alleges both that the defendants had a motive to entrench and that they acted consistent with that motive. Specifically, they knew that their jobs were on the line. At least one bidder had submitted an indication of interest, which is cited at paragraph 33 of the complaint, indicating that it would terminate the existing board and it would honor all severance obligations for the officers, making it clear that if the sale was approved, these individuals would be out of their positions. The court below nevertheless found that plaintiff's allegations of self-interest were unexceptional and that the complaint did not allege facts tending to call into question defendant's decision to reject the first-place bid. We submit this as wrong. There are numerous acts consistent with a desire to entrench oneself in office and act with self-interest. First, the officer suggested alternatives. That is, immediately after the board authorized the company to be sold, Stevens and Seferic, along with other members of management, promoted other courses of action that would allow them to keep their jobs. For example, the complaint at paragraph 29 alleges that at the very next meeting after the sale process was authorized, these officers submitted to the board an alternative proposal, which would allow them to keep their jobs, which was similar to the now advanced reclassification in that it allowed for a delisting of the company from NASDAQ. This conduct continued as alleged in paragraph 36 of the complaint. In advance of the meeting at which the three bids were to be discussed, Seferic, who is one of the officers and one of the defendants, prepared yet another presentation, which was distributed by Stevens, another defendant, again advocating an alternative to the sale that involved a delisting from NASDAQ similar to the now advanced reclassification.
The board that rejected the sale overture, how many directors were there and how many of them were interested?
There were five, Your Honor. And there were four that voted against the sale. One was Plaintiff Gantler. We believe that they were all interested. First, there are allegations.
Except for Gantler?
Yes. Excuse me. There are allegations in the complaint, and they're detailed in the briefs, and I can go through them, discussing the materiality of the benefits that they were protecting by voting down the sale in terms of board fees, their positions, options, title work, et cetera. But that's all in the complaint, and if with some indulgence, I'd like to instead today focus on the actions in addition to those material benefits that show self-interest. You know, self-interest is sort of a state of mind, and it can be shown not only by a motive, which there was here, but also actions consistent with that motive. And we believe that the complaint is replete with those actions. As I mentioned, first, the board advocate was told that there were alternatives. It's a reasonable inference from these allegations. Well, the board may have initially understood that a sale was necessary, that thereafter they realized that a sale would end their gravy train and that there were alternatives. Then they proceeded to vote the sale down. They did this despite the fact that it offered a substantial premium, despite the fact that KBW, the board's financial advisor, had opined that the first place bid was fair and indeed that it offered a price that exceeded its valuation metrics in most respects. KBW further opined that the upside of exchanging First Nile stock was stronger than remaining independent, given the prospects for First Nile stock over the long term. Yet without so much as discussing this advice, the board voted down the first place bid. Under these circumstances, and this is important, it's where the directors acted against the advice of their financial advisors and without any deliberation, plaintiffs submit that there can be no economically rational basis for the decision. Therefore, the board and the defendants cannot claim that they are entitled to an inference that they acted in the good faith pursuit of a legitimate shareholder interest.
This was a process that was lasting over a period of months, wasn't it? So the board was informed of the ongoing aspects of potentially selling the company, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But it's not just at the March 9 meeting that we allege that there was no deliberation. There was no deliberation at the prior meeting as well. That's because Defendant Stevens, who controlled the board's agenda, immediately after the presentation was given said, oh, thank you very much, advisors. We're not going to hold a meeting. We're going to wait until our next scheduled meeting. And they said, no, you can't do that. That's 2 weeks is a lifetime in the world of M&A. You have to hold a meeting. So finally, he succumbed, I would submit, because he knew that it was going to be voted down no matter what, scheduled the meeting. But even at the next meeting, the March 9 meeting, the advisors gave their pitch. They discussed the the bid, and immediately he called the vote. So this wasn't just no deliberation at one meeting. It was no deliberation at a series of meetings. Moreover, it was only by the time you got to the March 4th time frame that you had the final definitive bid. So there was no discussion of that final definitive bid, which had changed over time.
So is this gross negligence?
It exceeds gross negligence and, in fact, is indicative of self-interest.
Well, your claim, at least as you've described it, with respect to the first count, is that the directors preferred their own self-interest in not having the company sold.
Right, that's a loyalty issue.
In preference to the interest of the shareholders in having a transaction which was the most valuable one that had appeared on the horizon. Is that?
That's correct.
So it's essentially a classic loyalty case, as you described it. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Turning to the other transaction, the reclassification, the complaint also attacks that, and I think we understand that the basis for the attack is are the disclosures that were made to the shareholders. Are there any substantive fiduciary attacks apart from the disclosure claims?
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint alleges that the directors both breached their duty of loyalty, good faith, and care with respect to the reclassification as well. And in particular, the complaint alleges that the director defendants at the time, which were Stevens, who was an officer, Costanzas, who was an officer, Edie, Shaker, and Kramer, that a majority of those individuals were interested in the reclassification transaction and or beholden to interested members. The court below found that those allegations were well supported and instead ruled on the basis of ratification. Plaintiffs submit that the ratification ruling with respect to the reclassification was an error.
One question about ratification. The reclassification, in order to be accomplished legally, would have required an amendment to the certificate of incorporation, correct?
That's correct.
And under the Delaware statute, that requires a shareholder vote.
That's true, and it required a 50% vote.
All right. So how is that ratification? That is to say... isn't ratification and hasn't ratification in our case law been described as an additional shareholder vote in circumstances where a vote was not required?
I didn't understand that to be the case, Your Honor. I understood that you could, that while they were distinct concepts, that the same vote could suffice. However, if you're suggesting otherwise, I defer to your judgment on that. with respect to that vote, defendants have the burden to show that it was fully informed. Plaintiffs submit that it was not. There are at least four pieces of information that shareholders should have known about. First, the proxy misstates the reasons why there was no definitive bid submitted by Cortland and fails to mention that management did not cooperate with due diligence. This is a partial disclosure issue. The proxy does recite that there were three bids received. It then misleadingly claims that, quote, as a result of further negotiations, unquote, one of the bidders presented a definitive merger proposal. This wrongly suggests that there were further negotiations with both bidders, but that only one led to a definitive bid, suggesting that the company was not really a viable merger partner and it didn't have a viable merger alternative. But to be accurate, the board should have disclosed, and in particular having undertaken to disclose the Cortland bid, should have disclosed the full factual history as to why no firm bid materialized.
But, Ms. Eldham, let's assume for the sake of the argument that we were to uphold the Vice Chancellor's determination that there were no actionable misdisclosures or non-disclosures in connection with the reclassification. If that were to occur, is there anything left to the claim attacking the reclassification?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. All the parties agree that a ratification will only operate if a majority of the outstanding disinterested shares voted in favor of the reclassification after full and complete disclosure. Here, the Court of Chancery erred by taking judicial notice of the proxy's recitation of the affiliated shares that are shares affiliated with defendants as an indicator of the number of interested shares. But we submit that interested shares in this context has a different meaning, and interested is a factual question. If we were permitted to proceed, Your Honors, plaintiffs would argue that interested shares should include defendants' unallocated ESOP shares because they had the power to vote those shares, as well as all of the ESOP shares allocated, unallocated, held by a defendant, or held by other officer, because as a result of those reclassification, those ESOP shares were going to have a put and appraisal right, which gave them far more liquidity than the other shares as a result of the reclassification, making those shares interested. And that interest is something that the court below should have considered in making its ratification decision.
So the substantive attack is that there were insufficient votes cast to adopt the certificate amendment.
Well, and not that there were insufficient votes cast for purposes of the adoption, but if you're going to rely on ratification, it's just not a mere 50%.
But here the ratification and the adoption are one and the same, aren't they? I mean, we're talking about one shareholder vote.
One shareholder vote, but you look at different votes cast to determine the effect of approval versus ratification.
If you have one shareholder vote, how do you look at different votes?
Well, for one, you need a mere 50% majority. It doesn't matter. You don't, the directors and officers, anyone who's going to be affected can vote. It's a mere 50%. It's a regular corporate action. However, if you're going to rely on ratification, you need to show that a majority of the outstanding disinterested shares voted in favor.
So you're saying that it's possible legally to have an ineffective ratification but an effective vote?
The action can be properly adopted for corporate purposes. But if it was ineffective because it was promoted in breach of the officers and directors' fiduciary duties.
Well, let me ask it a different way. As I understand it, the reclassification passed by a vote of about 50.4%. Is that right?
I think it may have actually passed by a higher vote, but the vote that the court below looked at for ratification was 50.23 or 28%.
It was a squeaker. And as to that, I thought that the court was looking at that as the vote for all purposes.
No, I don't think so. I think the court had taken the defendant's shares out of that vote when it was doing its ratification math.
All right. Well, if we were on that view of what the court did, your argument would be there were insufficient votes cast to constitute a ratification, if there were sufficient vote cast to amend the certificate and affect the reclassification.
It's a little bit more subtle than that, in that it's not that there were insufficient votes cast, but the court on the record before it could not determine whether there were sufficient votes cast, because the court would need to make a factual determination of which votes were interested. And it could not do that on a motion to dismiss. It could not
do that
without. Well,
if the court were to do all that and to validate your claim, then the bottom line would be insufficient votes to constitute a ratification, correct?
Yes.
Which would leave the, if I understand it correctly, it would still leave the reclassification as having been validly adopted by shareholder vote. Is that right?
That's right, but in breach of the defendant's fiduciary duties, then it would create a situation where
in breach of the defendant's fiduciary duty of disclosure, and what else? What I'm really driving at here is if
we... The self-interested transaction.
Let me finish my question.
Sorry.
I understand that an effective vote would still be invalid if it were procured by misdisclosure. Let's assume there were no misdisclosures. Is there anything left of the claim?
Yes, there's an underlying claim that the reclassification was adopted in breach of the director's fiduciary duties, that it was adopted despite the fact that it would cause harm to the minority shareholders.
But if the shareholders know all of that and decide to approve it anyway, then is there any fiduciary duty claim left?
In order for the ratification to be effective, a certain amount of the shareholders have to approve it. And that amount is a majority of the disinterested directors. And our point is that you don't get to the majority of the
disinterested. But my question assumes away the ratification problem. That is, let's assume that you're right. There was no effective ratification. But there was an effective vote, at least numerically.
Mm-hmm.
If that vote were procured by a completely valid set of disclosures, that is, if all the material facts were disclosed, is there any basis to attack on substantive grounds the non-ratified reclassification?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, this is no different than, let's say, a merger where you have a 30% shareholder. And the 30% shareholder and the officers and directors breach their fiduciary duties in some way with respect to the merger.
But a merger is an adoption of a contract. Here we're talking about a change to the certificate of incorporation that, let's posit, was accomplished by a valid shareholder vote, where the shareholders were told all the material facts, including presumably whatever conflict of interest the directors had.
Yeah, but you just presumed away the ratification, correct?
Correct.
So you presumed away that the shareholders, that a majority of the disinterested shareholders voted in favor of it, and assumed that the vote was that, let's say that the directors and officers had 30% of the
shares. I'm asking, if you presume away the ratification, isn't the only basis to attack the certificate change, that is, the reclassification, disclosure?
No, Your Honor. The certificate change was adopted as part of the defendant's self-interest. It affected them in ways different from the minority shareholders. The minority shareholders lost their liquid market for their shares. They were harmed by that conduct, while the defendants were not. I
but
see
if
that
the shareholders say the shareholders agree to that, that is, knowing that they're going to lose the market for their shares, but agree to it anyway, and they're not coerced and they're not fooled into doing it.
But not a majority of the disinterested shareholders in your hypothetical have agreed to that. It's only
about,
a majority
you're talking
about
of ratification
the
then.
Right.
Okay, but I'm again trying assuming away ratification.
Right.
I think it's fair for me to point out, with apologies to Justice Jacobs, that either I fat-fingered the program or it started off at program number two, which leaves you about 3 minutes left for rebuttal. Did you want to save that?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case involves two very separate business decisions. First, a decision of this board not to sell the company after they, on their own accord, took to exploring the possibility of making a sale. And two, a decision much later to reclassify the shares of the company so that this small community single branch bank in a small town in Niles, Ohio, could cease being a public company and stop spending an enormous amount of time, money, and effort reporting to the SEC, trying to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley for very little in return because of the local base of their shareholders.
Can I stop you right there? Because I think your description of the facts don't necessarily comport with opposing counsel's view of the facts. And, of course, at this point, we're dealing with what's alleged in the complaint as opposed to what the facts may ultimately reveal. But at least as I understand it, the two decisions were not separate, as you suggest, but rather the allegation is that the board initially thought, for all of the reasons you were describing, Sarbanes-Oxley and administrative whatever, that it would be a good idea to see about selling the company, right? And solicited possible merger partners, and actually got expressions of interest at what apparently were considered fair prices. But that what went with those expressions of interest was a condition that the directors and management would not stay in office. And because of that reason, and presumably that reason alone, the directors abandoned their original plan and moved to the reclassification. Isn't that the gist of what's alleged?
Not actually, Your Honor. The complaint alleges that the directors and officers on their own accord looked for strategic opportunities, including an opportunity to sell, because they were facing what the amended complaint describes as a succession crisis, that they needed to look for new leadership. And that was the reason for looking for the sale. It wasn't about Sarbanes-Oxley being a public company that led to the sales decision. That is something that was sort of ever-present in the world of small community banking at the time, which the complaint actually does allege that this was a small single-branch bank and actually does also acknowledge that a stated reason for the reclassification or going private was to come out from under those burdens. But what happened was the company decided to look into the sales process, and that was in late summer, early fall 2004. Shortly after that, I think a month after they first started looking into the sales decision, at one of the board meetings, someone talked about the idea of going private for the very first time. It wasn't about reclassification. It was just about going private. This is a board who, of course, if they didn't sell, was going to have to continue operating as an independent entity. And that was something that following their duties as directors, they were going to look down the road and see, well, if we don't sell, we're going to have to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley. So that was something that was sort of in the back of their mind. So it comes up.
Well, doesn't the complaint allege that someone who had that idea was one of the incumbent officers?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, but not the directors. But what the complaint acknowledges is that they were considering the sale. The privatization comes up. But what the complaint also acknowledges is that they didn't take any action on that going private proposal whatsoever. They continued forward with the sales process for another 6 months without taking any action whatsoever on going private, much less talking about reclassification specifically. And then when the board ultimately decided not to sell in March of 2005, it was still another year and 3 months before they decided to reclassify. They spent that year and 3 months after the decision not to sell, considering what the effects of reclassification would be. They hired new outside counsel. They formed committees to look into this. So it was a completely separate decision. And the reason that I believe that plaintiffs talk about reclassification in context of the sale is that they want the court to believe that the reclassification was an alternative to the sale and that it was a defensive action and therefore UNICAL should apply. But we submit that that is not true, because not only, as I've described, were the two actions taken separate in time, which is a big problem to being a defensive action, because a defensive action, if you think about it, something's happening at the time and you want to defend against that very action from happening, so you take a defensive action to stop that thing from happening. That is not what happened here. The board simply decided not to sell, and then a year and 3 months later decided to reclassify.
Is that the only inference that can be drawn from the complaint?
Well, Your Honors, the plaintiffs also allege that the reclassification was defensive to perhaps a future sale, but defendants submit and argue that it's not. It's not a defense to selling, because the company could be sold post-reclassification. It could be sold now. And in fact, the proxy actually hinted about the possibility of a future sale even after reclassification, because it stated that one of the reasons for using reclassification as the way to go private as opposed to any other number of ways that they could have done it was that it allowed all the shareholders the opportunity to retain all their shares and therefore retain the equity interest in the company and participate in any future growth and earnings and any future value from the sale of the company. And that's at the proxy statement at page 12. So this was certainly still a possibility, and it was also highlighted in the proxy as a possibility.
Well, Ms. Evans, let me just make sure we understand your position. As I understand your argument, it is that the decision not to go forward with the sale. And the decision to propose a reclassification were two separate events. They were separated in time, and both of them were motivated by a business judgment as to what was in the best interest of the company and the shareholders. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, the plaintiff argues that while that may be a good defense, and it may be the fact that the complaint alleges that the two events were part of a single course of conduct. They were motivated by self-interest. That is, there was self-interest that drove the rejection of the sale option to the detriment of the shareholders. And it was self-interest that led to the proposal of the reclassification, which was affected by securing shareholder votes by the means of a misleading proxy. Now, isn't that, you know, whether that turns out to be the fact or not, isn't that inferable from the complaint? And if it is, didn't the court below err in dismissing the complaint?
No, Your Honor. There are, of course, there are allegations in the complaint that this was an interested transaction or that these decisions were one and the same, but those are conclusory allegations. If you actually look behind the allegations, what you see is that no one was interested in this reclassification. Nothing changed after this reclassification. It did not provide a what I think the plaintiff would characterize as a defense to entrenchment. It wasn't, they didn't, the directors and the officers didn't contain, didn't obtain a greater control over their fate than they had before. The number of shares, I think this was a point that we discussed at the last argument, the number of shares that weren't allowed to vote for directors after reclassification, that were allowed to vote for directors before reclassification, was 2.7%. It was only the reclassified shares that lost the ability to vote on director seats, and they still retain the ability to vote on any change of control, which was presumably the thing that this reclassification was supposed to be a defense against selling. And as I pointed out, it wasn't a defense to selling, but also it didn't take anything away from the shareholders regarding a sale either. And in fact, the plaintiffs weren't reclassified, and they still get to vote on director elections. And the officers and directors, they have 194,960 shares. It's about 17.5%. They don't have a lock on their positions. And, in fact, the plaintiffs collectively own 121,715 shares. So they have almost as much control over who is going to be running this board as the current officers and directors do.
Well, let's assume for the moment that if it had been done totally in a vacuum, having nothing to do with the prior conduct, and the board decides a reclassification is a good idea for a bunch of reasons. We're going to put it to the stockholders and see if they agree, and if they do, we're going to reclassify our stock. I don't think anybody would have much of a claim about whether that reclassification is valid or not, assuming the disclosure was adequate. On the other hand, if what was going on is that the directors decided we don't want to engage in a sale and lose our positions, so we're eliminating what we thought was a good idea, and we're eliminating that because of our personal interest in not having that result obtained, then at that point the reclassification arguably takes on a different tint, because now it is not necessarily defensive as such under UNICAL, but it is a step in the process of perpetuating the directors in office. Isn't that fairly inferable from the complaint?
No, Your Honor. Again, the complaint alleges that the officers and directors undertook this sales process as part of a strategic exploration process. One of the concerns, and the only concern alleged in the complaint as to why the sales process started, was a management succession concern. So it's not reasonable to infer from the complaint that these directors and officers didn't realize by undertaking the sales process that things might change, that they might lose their jobs or that they might lose their board seats. That's not a reasonable inference.
But I thought they specifically alleged that one or both of the offers that they received made clear that that would be what would happen? And after getting them, then all of a sudden they don't proceed any further?
Well, they actually, I'm sorry, Your Honor, they actually did proceed further. They proceeded for 6 months. If they really wanted to just end it, they could have ended it, and they didn't. They continued exploring it for 6 months, but specifically to the bids, the first place bid, the bid that was rejected in March of 2005, made no mention whatsoever about whether the current directors would be retained, and the complaint is silent as to what that bid said about management. The Cortland bid, another bid that materialized, did say that the current directors would not be retained, but they would be given an opportunity to apply if future board seats opened. And it mentioned that severance agreements would be honored. It didn't say anything specifically about for sure someone's going to lose their job and for sure no one on this board is ever going to have a say in what happens again. So it's not reasonable to assume that that they suddenly realized that things might change for them, either because of the fact that people know that when there are sales that occur, things change, but also because the bids themselves did not draw down the gauntlet and say, you guys are out if we take over here. And they continued for 6 months. They continued with deliberation and due diligence, and then ultimately came to the conclusion that the sale was not in the best interest of the company.
But isn't this the kind of fleshing out that goes on in discovery, that you may turn out to be right and the board was already cognizant of the possibility or likelihood that they would lose their positions and that didn't bother them and it had nothing to do with their decisions, or alternatively that it came as something of a surprise to be told that by the potential acquirer that you would lose your position and that in response they decided not to pursue it any further. Those would be two very different factual scenarios, but we don't know which one of them is accurate yet, do we?
Well, Your Honor, any time a board is deciding whether or not to sell, of course if they decide not to sell and they keep the status quo, someone and a plaintiff might always argue, well, they did it because they wanted to keep their seats, but Delaware law says that's not enough, and the Chancery Court below highlighted the fact that all we have here are routine and unexceptional allegations of entrenchment. We don't have any substantive allegations in the complaint to make us think that this was anything other than what normally comes up when a board is deciding whether or not to sell. And in this case, the board decided not to sell. In the proxy, it states they were concerned about there weren't price protections if the first place stock price fell. And that's a stated reason in the proxy as one of the concerns that they had. And it was a real concern because, as the amended complaint alleges, the first place stock price actually did fall during the six-month negotiation process. And so that's how the board ultimately got there. But it's always going to be a possibility that if there is a sale, that people might lose their seats or people might lose their jobs. And the courts are aware of that, and that's why Delaware law is clear that that's not enough without something else.
The complaint also alleged that one of the directors had an interest in continued title business with the bank.
That was Defendant Zuzulo, but the plaintiffs have given the court nothing in its amended complaint to infer that that was a material relationship for Mr. Zuzulo. They point out that the bank had to disclose that relationship because Mr. Zuzulo was on the board. But that was because that was material for the bank. It never alleges that it was material for Mr. Zuzulo. But coming back, Your Honors, I mean, there are two business decisions here, and the first one being the sales decision, the second one being the decision to reclassify. The question on both of those is, what is the appropriate standard of review? And for the reasons that I've stated, UNICAL does not apply to the decision not to sell because there were no defensive actions taken. This reclassification was no defense whatsoever to the decision not to sell. And the only other thing that the plaintiff offers as being a defensive action to the decision not to sell is the vote not to sell itself, which can't be a defensive action. Otherwise, any decision not to sell would be defensive and UNICAL would apply.
Well, the complaint alleges there were no deliberations, that they simply changed their mind. Now, they attribute the change of mind to a lot of things that you say aren't logical inferences from the complaint. But isn't that the allegation in the complaint, that there's nothing to reflect anywhere in any public disclosure that this was a deliberate decision to change their mind?
The plaintiff alleges conclusory, yes, Your Honor, that there was no deliberation, but the plaintiff's own specific allegations point out that there was deliberation. As was pointed out earlier, this process took place for 6 months. There were several meetings. There was a financial advisor hired. There was outside legal counsel hired. Due diligence took place. There's a lot in the amended complaint from which to infer that there was deliberation. There are allegations that during the meetings, the financial advisors were there and that they were expressing their opinions on the bids that they received so far, that they handed out materials. There's no allegations that these directors weren't at the meetings, that they weren't reading the materials, that they weren't paying attention or anything of the sort. And there's actually also an allegation that at a meeting in December, Mr. Stevens was expressing his opinions on stock price, and also that at a meeting in December, there was a handout called First Nile's Potential Price in 3 Years, indicating that there was some deliberation and there was some discussion about what is the price of our company and comparing that to all the bids that they had been receiving through their financial advisor. So while there is a conclusory allegation that there was no deliberation, the specific allegations in the complaint show otherwise, that there was adequate deliberation, and that is one of the that is what went into the Chancery Court's holding, that the proper standard here was to ask the question, is there anything in the complaint that shows us that this action wasn't taken in good faith or that it wasn't taken advisedly? And that, what I've just described about deliberation, is what went into the Chancery Court's answer that no, there's nothing in the complaint for me to take that this action wasn't taken advisedly. And also, there's nothing to show that it wasn't taken in anything other than good faith. In fact, the only allegations that plaintiffs offer as to why this might have been made in bad faith are, again, the things that are true in any decision not to do anything, that everything will stay the same, that there will be no change in status quo.
And assume there is no deliberation. What is that? Is that gross negligence? Is that bad faith or something else? What is it?
No deliberation whatsoever, Your Honor?
Right.
At negligence. If there was no deliberation, but that's certainly not what we have here. And even the plaintiff's complaint, even with the conclusory allegation of no deliberations, there's no allegations that they completely weren't comporting with their duties as officers by holding meetings, holding due diligence sessions. Again, they hired two advisors. And then again, this is a small community bank, and they hired outside financial advisors, investment banking firms, and a separate legal counsel, not the same legal counsel that they had for reclassification. So these were directors that were really trying to make sure that they got good advice on what they were going to do. So I just don't think it can be said that there was no deliberation and that they didn't take this action advisedly, because the amended complaint allegations, the specific allegations, show otherwise.
I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Zeldin. Was the concept of ratification appropriately applied in this case in connection with the reclassification?
Yes, Your Honor.
That is, in order to affect the reclassifications as a matter of statutory law, a shareholder vote was required.
Yes, Your Honor.
How can a statutorily required shareholder vote also constitute ratification?
Well, the law on ratification is, there's a lot out there and a lot to parse through. But essentially what the law says and what we argue and what the Chancery Court recognized was that obviously you have to have shareholder approval. That's the way that we get to reclassification. And that, Your Honor, incidentally passed by 700-and-something thousand votes to 200-something thousand votes.
Well, doesn't ratification cover those circumstances where a shareholder vote is not required, but one is obtained anyway in order to so-called get a leg up in terms of court review?
It can, but in this case, what happens was the court looked at, obviously all the shareholders got to vote, and they saw that they got the number of votes that they needed to pass reclassification, and then...
I'm sorry, I'm asking you a conceptual question. Don't drown me in words.
I'm sorry.
How can you have a... does ratification require a shareholder vote, or does it implicate a shareholder vote in circumstances where none is required?
it could. I mean, you could have a shareholder ratification to protect, to, as you said, shore up an action that perhaps didn't require it. But you can also use, when you do require shareholder approval, which is what we have here,
Shareholder vote can do double duty?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly why.
Do you have a case that supports that view?
Well, I believe the cases cited in the briefs talk about, in fact, I think this court's ruling in NRA General Motors was a case similar where the shareholders had to approve the actions that were taken, but it was also used to show ratification. And what the court did here was it gave the best case scenario to the plaintiff, assuming none of the shares that were voted by the officers and directors count toward finding a majority. You still get a majority, and that's why it seems like it's very close, 50.28%, but it's really not. I mean, that's assuming the best case scenario for the plaintiff.
How can we reconcile the vice chancellor's holding that there was shareholder ratification with the holding in the Santa Fe case, that is the 1995 case involving Santa Fe, which held that there can only be shareholder ratification with respect to conduct that is specifically presented to the shareholders for a vote? And as I understand it, here what was presented to the shareholders was the reclassification, but not a request that the shareholders approve conduct that was allegedly a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, what the shareholders were asked to approve was the reclassification, which is what plaintiffs contend is the defensive action. My understanding of Santa Fe is that the reason that ratification didn't work there is because it was Unocal applied there, and there was a defensive action. There was one merger, and then there was an alternative offer, and the alternative offer is the one that the board wanted, is the one that the shareholders voted on. They didn't get to vote on the first offer.
Well, they didn't get to vote on the defensive measures that led up to the transaction that was under attack in Santa Fe.
Exactly,
and
Your
therefore,
Honor.
Therefore, there was no shareholder ratification of that conduct, which was what the lawsuit was about.
Right, and
isn't
here,
isn't that equally true here?
No, Your Honor. I would contend actually the opposite, that the defensive action, what plaintiffs contend is the defensive action, was the reclassification, which is exactly what the shareholders got to vote on. And as you pointed out, got to vote on knowing that they were going to lose their public market, knowing that the directors and officers, that everything was going to stay the same for them, that they were going to have common shares and they were going to have different shares. So I would say Santa Fe, actually, the decision by the court in that case makes what we're trying to do here even stronger, because the shareholders did vote on the supposed defensive action, even though we would contend that it's not defensive. But even without ratification, the business judgment rule still applies to the reclassification decision, we would contend, because we respectfully disagree with the Chancery Court's holding that Mr. Kramer lacked independence from Stevens based on a potential speculative future employment that wasn't anything that was going on at the time. And again, that nobody was interested in this reclassification because, as I've pointed out, nothing changed. So we would submit that even without ratification, the business judgment rule should apply to reclassification.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello. A couple things. Once with respect to the ratification, defendants didn't argue below, and I don't read the court's decision below, to hold that ratification is an affirmative defense with respect to the sale process, and clearly that would have been improper under Santa Fe. With respect to the time delay between the two transactions, I think there's a very practical reason for that. The complaint alleges that Director Zuzulo passed away after he was tasked with investigating the reclassification option. That was in August of 2005. To the extent there was a five-month delay, that was because he was the one who was supposed to be investigating the reclassification. He didn't do anything during that time and then passed away. Moreover, there was really no need for the defendants to act swiftly on that second half of the allegations because at that point the bid was gone from first place. Their jobs were secure. They had some breathing room. And finally, as I think Justice Berger pointed out, while there are two separate damage claims, the facts are interrelated and they do show conduct consistent with a self-interested motive. Both the rejection of the bid informs the reclassification claim and vice versa. With respect to the defendant's claim cost savings, that evidence is obviously outside the complaint and improper for the court to consider on this motion. Really what the defendants are asking for is an adverse inference where all the inferences are supposed to be drawn in the plaintiff's favor.
Well, the cost savings was a subject of disclosure to the shareholders, wasn't it? That is, weren't the shareholders told that that was that cost savings were a reason to do the reclassification?
That's correct. They were told that.
So your argument is that while we can take cognizance of that fact in the sense that it was disclosed, it can't be used for the truth of
that's
the matter.
That's correct, and it can't be used to show a basis for the decision where we allege that the basis for the decision through well-supported allegation was not cost savings, but self-interest. Moreover, I just direct your attention to page 4 of our reply brief, where we do a sort of side-by-side comparison of the cost savings based on the documents that the defendants improperly submitted in the appellate record, and show that that would really be an illogical decision, given that the first place bid was ultimately worth more than $22 a share. We were talking about 8 cents a year in share price as a result of the cost savings. See that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the case under advisement and assess.
Thank you, Your Honor.